Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all characters and styles and their enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're exploring writing fiction. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome to this most fascinating inside story today, which will take us deep into the world of Victorian Gothic. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the next hour, and I just said that Victorian Gothic as if I know exactly what I'm talking about, which of course I don't, and which is the joy of these Goldster conversations, because there's nothing that you can't learn. Is Gothic Oliver Twist? Is it the Rocky Horror Show? Is it Dracula? Or even our competing book of the month for August, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness? And more of that later. Now, I do know one book that is Victorian Gothic, and it has shot straight into the Sunday Times bestseller list this week on its release. Its author is my fantastic guest today, and the book is called, oh yes, The Fascination. She has penned a series of brilliant Victorian Gothic novels, The Goddess and the Thief, The Somnambulist, and The Last Day of Leda Grey, set in the times of silent movies. Some of you may remember we had Ellen Cheshire on a few weeks back, who wrote about silent women of that era. The Fascination tells the story of two twins, Tilly and Kezia Lovell, identical in every way except that one of them stopped growing at the age of five. And in due course, her size and beauty drew a lot of attention, and not all of it desirable. This is a really compelling story about finding acceptance in a world where anyone different is at risk of scorn or abuse, or used for entertainment purposes in a Victorian fairground theatre. To take us further into the world swirling around The Fascination and Victorian Gothic, welcome the great Essie Fox to Goldster Inside Story.
Hello, lovely to meet you all.
Is that anything Gothic behind you there, Essie?
Well, not really, except this house is very old. I think it was built in 1840. And so it's just on the cusp of Georgian Victorian. It's in the Victorian era, but only by a few years. And so it has lots of Georgian elements. And I must confess, I was quite inspired by it when I wrote The Goddess and the Thief, a book you just mentioned, because I actually set it, as it were, in this house, the lot of it, and then in other scenes in another house in Windsor that I know. And so in a way, yes, it's certainly inspired me with Gothic thoughts. That's for sure.
So help me out here. And if any of our wonderful audience know what Gothic is, help me out too, because I'm talking about it all the time and I've got no idea what it is except for sort of crumbling spires and castles and that.
Happened.
So what is Gothic and what is Victorian Gothic?
I think I missed some of that. So I'm really sorry.
Did you vanish? I was just saying.
Did vanish? Yes, I'm so sorry. You froze for a moment, so I'm really sorry if I missed anything there.
Oh, that's all right. What is Gothic exactly, and what is Victorian Gothic?
Right. So I sort of divide this into three sections, and the middle one, as it were, I would say, is when the first book was written that is claimed to be the first Gothic novel, and that was by Horace Walpole in 1764. And it was the epitome of modern Gothic, it's often called, and that's the Castle of Otranto. So the Castle of Otranto is full of fevered tales, and it led on to even more fevered, generally speaking, romances based on twisting plots with usually an isolated protagonist who would be usually female, and she would be engaged in a mental or physical battle against good and evil, monsters, madness, disease, the supernatural. Very often drugs would be involved as a way of, sedating or causing fevered dreams. And there would be despair, and whether or not the illusions of ghosts were real, they would usually be there in the background.
Okay.
Very claustrophobic scenes with crumbling castles, dungeons, you know, walls dripping blood, ruined abbeys. And I think a particularly fevered one would be Matthew Lewis's The Monk, which was, it's incredible, really. If you think for its time, it's just full of suppressed sexuality and yearning. And it's also very blasphemous against Christian religion. And it's full of ghosts, and it's really quite horrific. But having said that that's the middle section, I would then go back and say that I think we often forget when we talk about the Gothic, things like Shakespeare, like Macbeth, right, or Spenser's poem, The Faery Queen, Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost particularly, so very Gothic and dark, and with all these elements, really the themes of good against evil. So I think we can look back to that.
Okay, so it's good against evil in a sort of dark atmosphere. So I just want to run some Dracula. Is Dracula a Gothic?
Yes, but that's coming forward to my third part, really. That's more in the Victorian era. When we come out of that Georgian era,
yeah,
and we come into the Victorian age, when we've really got into the, you know, loads of Gothic things being written in the pamphlets that were sold weekly as well. You know, had Varney the Vampire, which came before Dracula, which was if anybody wants to look up Varney the Vampire, it's very entertaining. And it's a very revered sir called Varney, who ends up eventually, he really isn't happy being a vampire. He ends up trying to kill himself. And in the end, he kills himself by throwing himself into a volcano. And that's the only way he can destroy himself. But I think it went on for years and years. So it's the equivalent of a lot of our children's comics today, only it was for adults, and it was just as a penny dreadful. That's what it was, a penny dreadful. So there was that sort of thing. But I think we move into the Victorian era. On the cusp, Mary Shelley, before...
It's Frankenstein, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Frankenstein. Yeah. And then I think you move on into the Victorian era, and you've got Dracula, and that all starts building up that sort of sense of the sensation novel.
So Gothic and Victorian are two different things. It doesn't have to be Victorian Gothic, the merging of these two cultures.
I think it all comes together. I think it all feeds on what came before, and also things going on elsewhere. I mean, you know, you had the French Revolution, and you've got the Marquis de Sade and his extremely dark, gothic, sadistic novels. And all of this is feeding into this sense of writing stories that are sensational, but also spooky. And it's just strange that there was this huge appetite for this sort of book. And everybody, I mean, I think like today, we're all influenced by what's going on around us, but if you think of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, that's also incredibly Gothic.
I was going to say, as you were mentioning that, the storm scenes and the house and the isolation and all of that, I was thinking there's got to be Wuthering Heights. So what drew you to this? I mean, you could have been writing cozy crime, you could have been writing fantasy or something. Why did you come into this genre?
Perhaps I would be better off writing cozy crime, I think.
When you're in the bestsellers list, so I mean, you're doing it. Obviously, you've hit a nerve somewhere.
Well, where did I start? Well, I think I've always been drawn to quite dark stories. And I do remember, and this sounds a bit tenuous, but being a very young child, and there used to be very late night films on a Friday night, usually black and white, usually quite old. And my brother and I would often sneak out of bed when our parents had gone to bed and go into the front room and watch these really, to us, scary films on television. And one of them was The Haunting of Hill House, an adaptation of Shirley Jackson's novel. It's the 1963 film that was directed by Robert Wise, not the later versions. And I think Claire Bloom starred in it. And it was just terrifying, but wonderfully terrifying. So it had, you've got an old Gothic house, a sort of creaking spiral staircase. You've got people in bed at night saying, "Hold my hand, I'm frightened," and then turning on the light and realizing that whoever's been holding their hand isn't the person in the next bed because they're fast asleep. It's been a ghost. And then you've got doors with banging noises and like a dog growling and panting outside and the doors bulging. Oh, it absolutely terrified us. We had to sort of go to bed holding hands with across our single beds afterwards. But I think that sort of thing, I realised it frightened me, but I loved it. And then I loved later on the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. And I really enjoyed those. They are very gothic. And when I went to university, one of the modules was Victorian novel. And that, of course, was filled with gothic and sensational stories. So I think really that all just fed into my interest in.
And when you decided to write your first novel, this was naturally the place that you wanted to be. There wasn't any question about doing something science fiction and.
Yes, it was really. But the funny thing I will say is that the first novel I wrote was the third novel to be published. So the first novel I wrote was The Goddess and the Thief, which is based, as I said, in this house.
Right.
And I think being in this house, looking around, thinking, what can I write about? And I decided to write about Victorian spirit mediums. Mm. But I also was somehow living in Windsor, I suppose. I'd come across, going up to the castle and reading up on things locally, I'd come across a character called Prince Dulip Singh, who had owned the Koh-i-Noor diamond before it was brought here. And I think I must have been researching the Koh-i-Noor diamond. I can't remember exactly. And I suddenly discovered this backstory about this prince. He was brought here when we actually went over and basically took over in India and northern India, which is now Pakistan, which is where he came from Lahore. And his story, I wanted to weave into a story that I could base in Windsor. So I had this spirit medium, and it's basically a heist. It's about wanting to steal the Koh-i-Noor diamond, which sounds absolutely ridiculous. But actually, I managed to weave all of these elements together and had elements from India and the Prince Dulip Singh and my spirit medium. And the way my thieves get into Windsor Castle is because Queen Victoria was mourning her husband so much. So basically, when Albert died, she actually used to invite spirit mediums to the castle here and from all over the place. So very quite famous at the time, spirit medium. Mine is totally imaginary, but I imagined her getting into the castle that way. And
You mentioned Queen Victoria. We have got a competition coming up, which has tangentially got Queen Victoria. We'll announce that in a second. And also, if anybody has got a favorite Gothic story, Gothic film, Gothic anything, put it in the chat. Got any questions, put in. I have one quick question before we move on to the fascination. When I was a child, there was a sitcom on, I think, called The Addams Family, where everybody was sort of black hair and looking like this. Is that Gothic?
Yes, definitely. And the whole thing about, wearing the black clothes and... Yeah. The jewelry.
But that's not a goth. That's a different thing when somebody, the younger people that call themselves goths, that's a different thing, is it?
I think it's linked more to I think it probably would have been based in that originally, but it's linked more to the clothing. So you've got this look of the clothing and often lots of piercings and tattoos. It's a slightly subversive, isn't it? But it's also a sense of belonging to a group that you feel. So a lot of, younger teenagers, I think, start off being goths, and it's kind of, certainly there's a lot of around Windsor, and
a lot of goths. You're not a goth, are you, or your children or relatives?
No, but I think obviously you've got the goth festival at Whitby twice a year, and Whitby is obviously linked to Dracula, and so I think that whole thing probably started with that, and it's developed into something else, and now there's a whole music element as well.
Yeah,
so it's a whole culture, isn't it? It's
Well, I hear it, and like when I was looking at Victorian Gothic, I pretend in conversations know what it means. I've got no idea what it means. So, I mean, I'm slowly getting there a little bit. But now I want to get into The Fascination, which was published, shot straight in the Sunday Times bestsellers list, as I said, two twins. And you begin, I'm just going to read one sentence from the book, and then I want you to tell us what it is. Some freaks are born and some are made. When it came to Tilly Lovell, it was a quirk of fate that the way I kept sprouting up reached a normal height when she stopped at 3'6". What is all that about, Essie?
Okay, well, I wanted to write, well, I started to write this book in lockdown. I was walking around Windsor and I was walking through what's called the Brockers, which are meadows on the River Thames, and discovered that they used to have rural fairs there. So they had all the Thames side fairs. And I started to write a novel, which I was thinking I would base in the Herefordshire rural countryside with travellers and lots of folklore and witchcraft. And I suddenly found myself changing my whole thought about it. So I do, I mean, Tilly and Kazir do, they are born in the Herefordshire lanes in a old black and white medieval cottage there. And that's where they start their lives. And there is sort of folky witchcraft involved to a certain extent when cures for illnesses and things like that. But they are born identical. But when Till is five, something happens. There's a violent incident. She has a very bad knock on the head. And after that, whether that has caused it or whether she would have been genetically simply predisposed, but probably not because they're identical twins, Tilly stops growing. And I researched that by looking into damage to the thyroid gland and things like that, or was it pituitary, but whatever stimulates growth hormone. And so basically she looks like she's a midget. She's tiny. And I've got a picture here. I don't know if you can see it, but when I was doing my research, I found this character, Princess Lottie was her stage name. And I don't know very much more about her, but she was said to be 9 pounds in weight and about a foot and a half high. So much smaller than my Tilly. Yeah. And it is incredible. There were a lot of freak shows, as we call them, which they called them, which had midgets. There seemed to be a lot of midgets. And what I was wondering is, was it simply that there wasn't the medication in those days? We were advanced now, so that a lot of people receive growth hormone if they're not growing. And there was a boy I was with at school who didn't grow after the age of 8 or 9, and he then was given growth hormone. And after being very, very little, he suddenly shot up. So perhaps these days we actually see less small people because of that reason. I'm not sure. But anyway, I decided I'd got their father. The girl's father is an absolute rogue, and he produces a quack elixir that he calls his miracle elixir, and he sells it around the fairgrounds, and he begins to think, I can use my girls as a prop on the stage. So he claims that the one who grew to be a normal height drank his elixir and is therefore a strapping girl and in the best of health, and the one who doesn't drink his elixir is stunted in her growth. In fact, it's the other way around, because Tilly, the little one, becomes completely addicted to this elixir, which is full of laudanum.
Yeah.
And that does have effects on the story as it progresses.
The father of the twins, monetizes his daughters these fairgrounds, which are quite common and around Britain, are they, for entertainment and that. And the freaks, this word you use, freaks, is what draws in the crowds. That's the sort of atmosphere situation that we're in.
So perhaps wonders in it's a difficult word to use today, and it's sorry, I missed that again. The internet connection seems to be unstable. Yes, I'm sorry.
Dodger, I think it's because you're in Windsor, you see.
I think it must be. I'm sorry about that. I don't usually have that problem, but
did you miss my question? I was just sort of encapsulating, if everybody's still hearing, is that you had the father that's monetizing his two daughters, and these fairgrounds that he does it at are quite common throughout Britain, and mm-hmm. it's the freak element of the people that are there that draws in the crowds. They come to look at somebody who's unusual.
I think yes, they do. I mean, they come for all sorts of different entertainments, but certainly that would be a big draw. And a lot of the poor afflicted people, some of them would do it willingly because it would be a way of finding security in their lives and also earning money. and being protected when they weren't actually being perhaps mocked or you know, on the stage. But when they weren't on the stage, whoever contracted them, whoever ran the shows, would actually take care of them and would protect them from the outside world, because otherwise they might end up on the street begging and totally being abused. And I mean, I'm not saying they led wonderfully happy lives. I don't think they would have done, but this was a way for them to actually exist unharmed.
And I just want to bring in our competition now. And the winner of this is going to get a signed book sent and signed by Essie. The question, Essie? I think we're frozen again, aren't we? Essie, are you there? Ah.
I am, yes. Yes.
Did you hear that this was the question to the competition?
Yes. Yes. So the question to the competition is, P.T. Barnum, the great American showman, he actually did have a very famous midget in his troupe of performers. And that midget actually came to meet Queen Victoria and was exhibited all over Europe. And I just want you to tell me what the name of that midget was.
The name of the midget in Barnum's thing, put it in the chat. And the first person in, or the one that's got the funniest comment with it or something, somebody will win a signed copy of Essie Fox's book, The Fascination. I want you to tell us what happens to the twins without giving any spoilers. And then I want to talk more about this thing about freaks and midgets and that sort of thing.
Celia's got it.
Celia's got it.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Congratulations, Celia. Yeah.
We better put another question there. Anyway.
Actually, General Tom Thumb, but maybe he was also called Captain Tom Thumb, but Tom Thumb, definitely.
Captain Tom Thumb. Okay. Well done, Celia. If you email Joe, we'll be in touch, get your address, that'll get to Essie, you'll get a book. Yeah, lovely.
Definitely, definitely. So what were we saying before I got excited?
I just want you to tell us as much as you can about the narrative arc of the twins without any spoilers. And then I want to talk about this terminology we're using, freaks, midgets, that sort of thing.
Okay, so the girls are monitorized in the extreme by their father. They actually start, they're about 15, 16, they actually start being afraid that he's going to start selling them in ways that he really shouldn't, being a father with his daughter. That doesn't happen. He does sell them though. He gets very drunk one night. He gets very angry because he finds them trying to escape. And he basically sells them in a rage to a very mysterious Italian who turns up at the fairground, who's known only as Captain. And so you don't really know at first what their fate's going to be with Captain. But he is very much involved in the entertainment world. He plays at these country fairs, but he also is very involved with the London pantomimes, Drury Lane. And he takes them back to a big Gothic house in Chiswick, on Chiswick High Road. And there he looks after them. He has a little family, as it were, of different people who are different, outcasts, socially excluded. And they together make a sort of family. And they also become very involved in the theatrical world. And it's when Tilly becomes involved in a Christmas pantomime, when she plays the Fairy Queen, which she is perfectly equipped to do, she draws attention from the wrong sort of people who then try to abduct her. And it's really, the story is what happens to Tilly, and how she is rescued or not, and how everybody comes together to try and effect that rescue.
And Tilly and Kezia stay together, do they? Or are they separated?
They do get separated at one point.
But because they do rely on each other as twins?
Very much so. And they're very, very different. Although they look the same. Tilly, the little one, is actually very outgoing and loves to be on the stage, absolutely adores it. Kezia is more reserved and is more spiritually inclined. She has a sense of intuition. And their great-great-grandmother was a traveller and used to tell misfortunes. So I have elements of that in their backstory, and she also, and one of those curses is described in quite good detail. And Kezia uses that skill to some extent, whether or not she really, you know, does have a sort of gift or not, that is used and incorporated in the story. And so, yes, they are separated at one point, but they will come together again, definitely.
So give us an idea. I don't know how to describe the morality or the values of that time. Firstly, are we in Charles Dickens's Victorian England here? Is that?
Yeah, 1880s, a bit later, 1880s.
So
and in fact, Dickens is mentioned as well, very much so, because one of my characters, I have two main narrators. I have Kezia, she's the older sister, the bigger sister, I should say. She is the one main narrator, and the other narrator is called Theo Seabrook, and he is the grandson of a wealthy landowner. In a house that I know, a big house that I've sort of used as a basis for that, which is quite nearby here, called Dorney Court, and I call it Dorney Hall in the book. But he's the other narrator, and he basically is desperate to leave home and be a doctor, and his grandfather keeps stopping him doing that, and in the end, he ends up in an anatomy museum as an assistant, but that's more in the future of the book. But his old nanny, when he's still living at Dorney Hall, Miss Miller, is obsessed with Charles Dickens. And she tells him a story. They're walking over the fields to go to the fair one day from Dorney Hall all across the Brockers fields to get there. And she's telling him how she'd read that Charles Dickens had been to visit his mistress who was living near.
Okay.
And how he had, and this is based on a true story, and how he had actually was heading home to London one night and was walking across the fields from Slough to Windsor railway station, because Windsor station used to go direct to London. Now you have to go to Slough and then get a shuttle. But in those days, it went directly. And he got lost, foggy and wet, and darkness came, and he just ended up walking round and round his... and got very ill, was one of the illnesses that led to ultimately to his exhaustion and his death. But I think it would have been towards the end of his life, definitely.
Yes. Give us an idea of, I mean, we've used this word freaks, you use it in the book, and we'll talk in a moment about when that became unacceptable. But what did they look like? What did people, what was the attraction of this sort of different human being that attracted people?
People... prurient, if that's the right word, interest in anything that's different. And I think we're still like it now. We love to people watch, don't we? And we love to see people in difficult situations in the way that people used to pay to go and watch hangings or beheadings or, you know, drawing and quartering, which is hideous to think of. But that sort of thing used to draw enormous crowds. And there is something in human beings that attracts them to what is different. So, you know, there were lots and lots of different sorts of people, anything. You know, you had Siamese twins, you had Chang and En, the Siamese twins who were joined by a thick band of flesh here at the chest. Now, nowadays...
And they would perform, would they? They would come onto the stage and recite poetry or something, or what would happen?
They would just basically stand there and let people... I think they would just stand there and let people look at them, and people would just be, oh my goodness, you know, this is shocking. Others might perform poetry. I'm sure that they would probably incorporate more into their acts than just standing there. But so you would have things like Siamese twins. I have a picture here. I have a character in the novel who lives in Captain's House in Chiswick. And there's quite a gothic story about that house, actually. And that character I have called a less, and I have based him on this real life character who was called Fedor Jeftichu. And Fedor was again ultimately contracted by P.T. Barnum, but before that, as a child, his mother sold him. He was Russian, and she sold him to a French circus. He was going on tour all over Europe. He was, as you could see by that picture, incredibly hairy. And the story they put about was that his mother had been in a forest one day and then was raped by a bear or a wolf. The story would vary. And this was the result, and that she was so ashamed when he was born, which she probably was because he was very hairy from a very little child, that she ended up selling him to a circus. And so he was toured around, and it was said, and it was also said by P.T. Barnum, that he couldn't speak. He could only growl or bark or howl at the moon. In fact, he was incredibly well-read. He could speak several languages fluently, which he picked up traveling around in the circus. And he was desperately homesick all his life to go back to Russia, and even went, trying to appeal to government, could you let me try and get in touch with my mother? I want to visit her again. It wasn't her fault. She sold me. She was pressurized. She was happy. And he was...
And we've lost you again, Essie.
He's deep on and cooked. Phil was such dying at the age of 40 of pneumonia. How far did I get to?
You're talking about him being homesick, but I just wanted to say, tell us about P.T. Barnum. I mean, he made his living out of selling these shows, these freak shows, did he?
Yes, absolutely. Well, not just that. I mean, he had all sorts of shows, but yes, his freak show. And of course, there was a film made of that, The Greatest Show on Earth.
Yes.
That was quite romanticized. I think that was quite romanticized.
Yes. And then as you were talking, I remembered that King Kong, that movie, fictional as it might be, ended up with him being in a freak show in New York, didn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. Oh gosh, yes. I'd forgotten about that. Definitely.
So a very sad character because a bit like the Russian that you mentioned just now. He was homesick, and King Kong was in love with Jane, and in this sort of different land. So, I mean, what other? Because the other one is The Elephant Man, isn't it? Which was the famous film of 20, yes. 30 years ago, and he had some sort of tumours or skin condition?
Tumours, lots of tumours that grew, and bone deformities, really. So his skull actually became so heavy in the end that he couldn't hold his head up. And that's actually how he died in the end. I think he suffocated because the weight of his head just put too much pressure on his windpipe. Terribly, terribly sad.
Yes, it's... But let's get back to the morality or the values. So people, we are naturally attracted to, as you said, a hanging. We sort of, crowds go to that. And then you're naturally attracted to see King Kong or Tilly or something like that at a show. When did that stop? I mean, when did somebody say, no, actually, this isn't right for us to do this?
It really carried on. I don't know exactly when it would have stopped. Obviously, we don't do it now, although I think we have our own sort of versions of freak shows in things like Big Brother or the jungle,
Yes, we do.
Because the people themselves aren't freaks. Usually they're incredibly beautiful and very young, but they're doing freakish things to each other or humiliating each other. Yes. And I think that's our current sort of version. I don't know if anybody can think of anything else that we do. But really, yes, there was a wonderful series I once watched called Carnivale, which was based about in the American Dust Bowl. And that was all about a traveling show full of people who are different. And that was actually based on reality, I think. So certainly, and in the film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, that's going back to Victorian times, but there's... who is used as literally as a meal ticket until a chicken comes along that does a better trick, and then he is disposed of.
I remember that, and there are crowds listening to him reciting Shakespeare.
Oh, and he did it so beautifully, and it was so utterly, it was so moving, and he was just treated as a commodity, like yes. No more value than a chicken.
Yes,
and less value than a chicken.
Right. I think this is a very fascinating. So when you're writing this and you've talked to us on this show about freaks and midgets and that, Did you have to temper your language for this current, the current atmosphere today? Is there are two things in writing books. There's what's called appropriation, and that's how dare you write about this if you're not a freak or a midget yourself. Yeah. And the other one is the terminology that you're using as to whether that's acceptable or not.
It's very difficult. And so when I'm talking, you know, to you now about literally about the era, I think to use the word freak is more acceptable because obviously that is what they were called. They were the freaks and wonders of the age. I think today, no, it's not acceptable, is it? I it's difficult. I tend to, you know, just talk about being different or other. Actually, one of the inspirations for the book is a very good friend of mine who has Down syndrome. And she really inspired my character of Tilly, because although Tilly has a different sort of difference, Millie, my friend, is actually incredible. She loves performing. She is never happier than when she's on a stage singing or acting. She is actually quite able. And she's not vocally challenged.
She looks different when she's on the stage. So people
know. She looks different.
Yes.
She looks different. But I think it's important for me that we all accept that. So one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was it's about acceptance. It's about somebody might look different, but they, you know, let's just accept them and let's just take that to our hearts. And actually, they might be looked on as monsters, like my character Valesky, because he's so hairy and people think of him being like a werewolf or even, I think in the Victorian era, anybody hairy like that, they would look at then with Charles Darwin as being more related to the monkeys than developed. So they think that they were retarded in that way or linked more back to the apes rather than being a present day human, which was...
How do you think that our attitudes have changed? Obviously they have, and what was going on then would now be illegal. But that thought process, that attraction that you were talking about that draws us to these things, has that changed? Are you there, Essie?
Sorry, I'm just... Would you mind if I got up and walked into another room to see if we can improve this?
No, we can get it. We can, in fact... Go and do that, and I will. We'll turn the show around. I'll tell people what's coming up, and then you come back. And
I'm sorry about this. I don't know what's happening. It's very odd. Okay.
Do that. So whilst Essie is going to get a better signal and come back,
we have.
Oh, you're there already? Are you?
Nearly.
Oh, okay. Then we'll just watch you move. Anybody's got any comments on gothic? This word freak. This word midget. Down syndrome performers. This is becoming a fascinating conversation. Join in and put it in the chat whilst we... Ah, now you're looking studious and less gothic.
Yeah, all my wires behind me, but they're not the internet wires, unfortunately, but I hope it will be better here.
Yeah, you're looking better, sounding better. And
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, gosh.
Don't worry. No, we've had it's fine. But my last question was whether you think, because you were researching the book, you were writing it, and then you were going out amongst the good folk in Windsor and elsewhere having normal conversations about things. Have our attitudes changed? And people that monetized that, you know, and sold people on and off, were they bad people or they were just lived in a different era?
I think I'm sure that some of them, what would attract you to do that? I don't know. I suppose they were what we might call entrepreneurs in a way. Perhaps they came across somebody with that condition, whatever that condition might be, and suddenly ka-ching saw a way of making money. I suppose they were just showmen in the way that some showmen, I mean, I have in my novel... one, it's nothing to do with using real people, but it's something that used to happen a lot. They used to get people to gather inside a tent that was very dark, lit by candles or lamps, and they would have a little mini stage, and they would have wax models, and they would reenact scenes from the Bible or great events in history. And I actually have one character getting rather worried, saying, oh, I do hope they're not going to reenact the funeral of Prince Albert again. It'll be just too upsetting. And they used to do things like that. So they would reenact great battles. And that was one form of showmanship. Obviously, there would be singers, there would be performers, fire eaters, magicians.
Just kidding, because I think when we talked yesterday before the show, you said that you had a hermaphrodite character that you didn't put into the book. So did you, why didn't you put this character in the book? And why do you have to tone things down, tone them up?
Well, to be absolutely honest with you, yes, I nearly did. And what brought that on? You know, because that is another form of being different. And there were hermaphrodites who were probably in, I don't know, I mean, perhaps in the Victorian era, it might be in sort of more private clubs and things like that, because there were, I'm afraid, you know, brothels and places that actually catered for people who had specific interests, shall we say. But I had been doing some research into Byron, and discovered that one of his, he had lots of, you know, things collected on his various travels and his various interests. And he had a little statuette of a hermaphrodite. And I thought, okay, yes, that's interesting. I could have a hermaphrodite in my novel because it would fit perfectly. But I started to think about this novel in the time of lockdown. And then more recently, of course, you know, there's all the discussion about the trans issue. And I did not want to upset anybody who might feel that they are different and that they're not being accepted. And I could just foresee perhaps offending people on both sides, even though, you know, I cause any offense.
And also it would distract if it did become an issue.
I decided to avoid that.
It would distract from the book, wouldn't it? But I can see the issue possibly of having hermaphrodite in a freak show or something like that.
Yes, in the end, I decided I had enough. I didn't want to overpopulate my book with too many characters. So basically, I've got Tilly and her sister Kazia, and I've got Leski, who is extremely hairy, and I've got Martha, who... pen theft palette and else, which would have made somebody look very different. I hope you can hear me. I think it's gone on again. So basically, Martha's got a cleft palate, and in those days, there would be very much chance of correcting that. Whereas again, now it's like people being given a growth hormone to grow. Then, if you had a hair lip or cleft palate, you would be stuck with that face. And people would mock you. Martha is very, very, very secretive about her appearance and hardly ever goes out. But actually, one of the characters who wants to become a doctor, this is Theo, my other narrator. He basically, when he meets her, he's looking into the history of cleft palates and how they were dealt with. Because in the anatomy museum where he works, they have a wax model of an example. Mm-hmm. And so... he sort of looks into how you would actually cure it and how they used to use a piece of wood sometimes to join the lips.
Okay.
And all sorts of different methods. And they were just beginning to discover how to correct it in the Victorian era. But what I must say, and this is something else that's very gothic, he works in this anatomy museum and it's set in Oxford Street in London in a shop, which goes back and back. And it has, in the shop at the front, it has all sorts of quack elixirs, all sorts of different dried frogs, all sorts of different witchy things that people could buy. Also pamphlets on venereal disease or on birth control, which all of this is true. There was a Dr. Khan, I don't know if he was really a doctor, and he had this museum of anatomy in Oxford Street in a shop. And people could go through this black velvet curtain to the back, where the rooms at the back would hold all these wax models or taxidermied models of freakish animals, like cats, you know, that have six legs or a two-headed carp, but lots of human ones as well. And he also had what they call an anatomical Venus. And the anatomical Venus they were very expensive and they were often made in Italy. And they would be like a wax model of a woman with long, real golden hair to wear a choker. Reclining. And as they reclined, you could actually take the abdomen off and see their internal organs, even a baby in a womb.
Oh, goodness. This is... But there's one thing, and I want to get onto your other books in the time we've got left, but just a question is that you talk about people being mocked because they're different. That's if you're living in the community. But when they're in part of the shows, they're not mocked, are they? They're then admired.
They might have been. I think some people would have gone out of, you know, just general interest. But I'm sure, especially in the fairgrounds,
yes,
you would have had groups of young men, drunk lads. Right. You know, yes. they would be drinking ale, beer, whatever. Yes. So you can just imagine they would have been mocked. They would have been abused, definitely.
Goodness, how? Now you've written other books. All of them are Victorian Gothic, if I've got it right. Just take us through them. And they're all standalones, I think. They're not part of a series. Just take us through each one and encapsulate for us The Goddess and the Thief.
The Goddess and the Thief is set in Windsor and Lahore in India, and it's about spiritualist mediums and someone from India coming over who believes in the Hindu faith and certain myths and predictions that are linked to the Koh-i-Noor diamond, and he wants the diamond for his own means to try and make these myths come true, and the spirit medium wants them simply for her own financial means, and they use a young woman, that's the Gothic element of a young woman isolated alone, in their attempt to get the diamond.
Right. And the somnambulist. What is a somnambulist? It's a sleepwalker, isn't it?
It's a sleepwalker. So the somnambulist is about a young woman who basically is unaware of the realities of her life. She's certain things about her birth. She's been lied to. She basically believes the lies, even though it's perfectly obvious to everybody else what's going on. So I wanted to have a character who literally, it was as if she was asleep, as if she was just blind to the truth. And because she's blind to the truth, she gets caught up in a man who comes along and asks her to go and become a companion to his wife, and relationship, the girl gradually becomes exposed.
Yeah. There is
a ghost as well, a sleepwalking ghost.
And the other one is the... Oh, my notes have gone here. The
Last Days of Leda Grey.
Yes, the silent movies. Tell us how that goes into the Gothic.
Yeah, well, that starts off in the 1970s, and I had to do that because I wanted to have a woman who was in the early Edwardian, late Victorian silent films who would still be alive. And so she would be in her 80s in the 1970s. So I have a journalist goes down to Brighton, goes into a junk shop, sees a photograph, a very old photograph of this woman dressed up as an Egyptian queen from a film that she was in, basically looking like Theda Bara. I don't know if you know what Theda Bara looked like when she played Cleopatra, but I based her looks on that. So he finds out she's still alive and decides to go and interview her. And she lives in the Clifftop House, which has a big film studio at the back, which is now crumbling and decaying and half of it's falling into the sea. And all the props from her films are still in there, but she lives there alone. And basically through telling him about her films, and each time you get the script of the films, they were very short.
Yeah.
And they're all quite dark, and they use a lot of trick photography that was Jeff Bean to use.
Yeah.
And basically he learns about it, and he discovers lots and lots of quite scary things. It's really quite scary, and it basically is a ghost story.
Okay. And when you're imagining and thinking of your plots and things, is the getting the location right, the description of this environment that you so vividly described to us, must be as important as the plot and the character?
I think the settings are almost like another character in themselves. And I'm quite a visual writer, and it's important to me that my readers absolutely feel that they are there in that place and that they can see it. And I really love that.
Do you draw sketches of what they would look like? Or
no, I don't. But, you know, I used to, before I started writing, I didn't start writing till I was 50. And before then, I did work in publishing when I first left university. I worked in London for a publishing company and then got pregnant and left. And then I wanted to find something I could do at home. So, of course, nowadays I probably could have done the publishing work because everything can be remote. But then in those days, there was nothing like this. Yes. And it was all telephones and typewriters. And anyway, I decided that I can draw and paint,
yeah,
to a certain degree. And I started working in illustration and ended up doing that for a long, long time, probably 25 years.
And were these stories knocking around in your head?
I've always had stories in my head, and I love reading. I'm an avid reader, and so yes, they were in a way. And I think when my daughter left home, and this sounds a bit weird, but I was sat down one night in this very room where I have a TV, and I looked for something to watch on TV, and I thought, "There's nothing I want to watch," and I suddenly thought, "Maybe I'll just write my own story," and that's what I started to do. And I found it addictive, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I plot novel. So gradually it unfolded, and it was watching EastEnders or something like that. You know, I didn't know what was coming with each episode.
And what do you think it is that catapulted the fascination into the bestsellers list?
I honestly don't know, because I have a new publisher, so maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah.
My first four books were published by a very large publisher who are wonderful, but I think when you're in such a big company, it is quite hard to get the publicity and marketing. The budgets are there, which you don't have with a smaller company, but I think the sheer enthusiasm of the smaller company I'm with now has been wonderful. And maybe that's brushed off on people. I don't know. Or maybe the themes of being different have just connected with people. I don't know what it is this time. Maybe, you know, lockdown writing suited me. Maybe that total immersion in a story made me write a better story.
Maybe we'll find out, because another of the guests we had earlier on in Goals of Tim Marshall, who does The Prisoners of Geography and very non-fiction bestsellers. He's with a tiny publisher too, and he's a worldwide bestseller.
Exactly.
So maybe you... Celia says, "I have read a book about the Queen's fool. Way back in Tudor times, the Queen kept..."
Yes, Geoffrey Hudson.
You know about this, yes. Do you? Tell us about
it. I know about him. And I'll tell you how I know, Celia, and this happens sometimes when you're writing. Before I started to write The Fascination, and this is probably where Tilly came from actually as well, before I started to write that, I started to write another book because I discovered Queen Henrietta Maria had, in the court of Charles I, maybe there were later ones as well in the Tudor court, but this one was Henrietta Maria had a little group of, she collected three. One of them was Geoffrey Hudson, and he was given to her as a present when he was a little boy. He was bought from family. I think his father was a baker or a butcher, something like that. And Geoffrey grew up with the Queen, and he actually went into exile with her to France when Charles I was arrested. And he had the most amazing life. He was a proportionate midget, like my Tilly. He was tiny, but, you know, all in proportion, his arms and legs. It wasn't dwarfism in the sense that the disproportionate...
Yeah.
He was proportionate.
He was just compact and smaller than
Yeah, and it is fascinating for me. So I started to write it and I thought, wow, I'm onto gold here because, you know, nobody's going to know this story. Obviously, Celia does. And I was halfway through writing it when I had an email from a publisher saying, we wonder if you would like to read this proof copy of a book we are publishing called The Littlest Man.
Oh my goodness.
If anybody wants to read it, it's excellent. I really enjoyed it, but I had to stop writing, obviously, because, you know, it's such a specific story about one specific person. So I thought there is no point me carrying on. So maybe in the end it was a good thing because it led me to the fascination because I was already, you know, rather fascinated indeed by the idea of that small person and the adventures he had and the influence he had on somebody in a very high position in society.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, wait there, Essie, for a couple of seconds. I'm going to tell our wonderful audience what we've got coming up, and then I'm going to come back to you because on August the 25th, I'm way into the future here because I'm hosting Book of the Month, and that's our freewheeling non-recorded conversation where anybody can say anything. Now, last time we chose between Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed and Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses, and in a haphazard kind of Golden's focus group, Kafka won, and we discussed Metamorphoses. What a great discussion that was. In August, the choices between that poor runner-up, The Bullet That Missed, and Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. So far is neck and neck. In fact, I think Heart of Darkness has got one extra in that. But put in the chat now, if you can, which you prefer, and mid-July, we will pick up and discuss the winner. Tomorrow, Lucinda is with the novelist of uplifting relationships and romance, Mike Gale, on his latest book, A Song of Me and You. That does sound, I like that title. July the 11th, Lucinda, On a Purpose, Passion and Grit with Gary Hayes, the man who built the world's first zero emissions camper van or recreational vehicle. I wonder how that works or whether it works. July 13th, I'm with Barbara Berger, multi-million best-selling author, and her latest is Healthy Models for Relationships. That's good relationships with your partner, family, parents, children, friends, enemies, of course, and all those other people in your life. Keep them balanced. Join us for that one. July 14th, confidence expert Natalie Plamondon Thomas and her book, Think Yourself Confident. Have had that nagging feeling in the back of your head that you're not good enough and it's not going to work? I have, but don't get sucked into it because otherwise we would never have created Goldster. So come and join us for that one. And Essie, I have to ask you about that. Do you ever think, oh my God, I can't do this book. It's too complicated. I'm not up to it.
Yes, I do. But what I've discovered now, and I've realized now that I've written 5 books, is that from the time I finish one until the time I start another one, I've realized it's 6 months. And in that 6 months, if I try to write anything, I just can't. I just feel, I don't know whether I'm mentally a bit tired or I just lose my confidence totally and think I'll never be able to do it again. And then usually at about 6 months, the urge to write is so strong that I just sit down and start doing it.
That's right. So you do a 6-month gap where your mind refreshes, naturally refreshes. You might be frozen again, but I'm going to ask you, which one would you go for? Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness or Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed?
The Heart of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness. I think that's 2 up for Heart of Darkness. I'm going to look at our chats, see what people are putting in there. And finally, before I do that, Goldster our demographic is for the over 50s. I know you're too young to ask this question too, but the over 50s, when you're getting to that stage of life, empty nesting, maybe retiring, maybe whatever, what tip can you give us to sort of keep going and keep doing things?
As I said before, I started writing at the age of 50. I always wanted to write. I always had stories in my mind, but I never thought I'd have the confidence or the ability to do it. And suddenly I thought, it's now or never, I'm going to have a go at this. And I think if you really want to do something, if you have a story you want to tell, then do it. Have a go. It doesn't matter. If it doesn't lead anywhere, it doesn't matter. You will enjoy it. You will gain something from it. And you will know that you tried.
Yeah. If you've tried, even if it doesn't work, just go for it. We're getting a few things here. Celia wants And Celia, you're a very special audience today because you won the competition. You've gone for Heart of Darkness. Oh, goodness. Let's see. And there's another quick message there. Heart of Darkness from Gene Joyce. First read it for O-levels in English. Didn't understand a word, so I hope I can mend sakes of it now. It's a thin book. Read it, and we will. It looks like that's going to be the one that's winning. Goodness, so time's wind chariot is upon us. We're running a little bit late. What a lovely, exciting book. Goals to conversation we've had. Thank you for the comments. Questions, curiosity on Victorian Gothic and moral values. Until tomorrow with the beautiful Lucinda and Mike Gale, stay active, stay curious, stay conversational, stay safe. And if you're inclined to stay Gothic, and of course, stay Goalster, Goals to Gothic. That could be a brand that we're doing. Better still, persuade friends, family and enemies to come and join the Goals to Fun. And thank you, SC Fox, for a great, captivating, I'll call it the fascination of the Goals to Conversation. Thanks so much, Essie, and bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goalster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goalster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goalster.